This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to look at the conservative wing of the Republican Party, its differences with the more moderate wing, and the influence of Christian conservatives within the party. My guest, David Kirkpatrick, is a reporter for the New York Times who covers the conservative movement's issues and leaders. It's a new beat that was created at the beginning of the year. Kirkpatrick previously reported on the publishing industry for the Times. This week he's reporting on the Republican convention. He co-authored today's front page story headlined "Social Conservatives Wield Influence on Platform." One of the most controversial parts of the Republican platform, controversial within the party itself, is the plank about same-sex unions. What do you know about what the platform disagreements were like?
Well, the original draft of the platform very closely mirrored the stance the president has taken on the subject of gay unions. That is, opposed to gay marriage, but leaving it up to states to recognize other forms of same-sex union like civil unions or domestic partnership. The platform committee met right after Vice President Dick Cheney, at a meeting in Davenport, Iowa, had said some more permissive things. He said that he disagreed with the president and thought that the whole matter of how to define marriage ought to be left up to states. Some of the conservatives in the party were upset by that, and they say, in reaction to that, put on a push within the platform committee meeting to strengthen the language in the platform, to go past what President Bush had previously said, and to condemn civil unions, gay civil unions, as well as gay marriage.
Could you read the passage in the platform plank about gay unions that was added at the request or under pressure by conservatives?
Sure. I'll start with one sentence that was in the original, and then I'll read the addition. "We strongly support President Bush's call for a constitutional amendment that fully protects marriage." That was the original part. Here's the addition. "And we believe that neither federal nor state judges nor bureaucrats should force states to recognize other living arrangements as equivalent to marriage. We believe, and the social science confirms, that the well-being of children is best accomplished in the environment of the home, nurtured by their mother and father, anchored by the bonds of marriage." That's the nub of it. It goes on from there to make clear that they frown on other kinds of unions that would provide the same sorts of benefits as marriage to same-sex couples. But the thing that's so bothersome to people within the party who would like to emphasize tolerance is that that passage goes out of its way not just to say, as the president has, we're up against the wall here and we've got to do something about this marriage matter or else a handful of judges are going to redefine it for the whole country. That's the president's line. This goes further than that and says, we think that gay people are less qualified to be parents and we want to put them down a little bit.
So, you know, this plank says that the Republican Party is opposed to civil unions, not just gay marriage. How strongly is that part of the plank endorsed by Republicans in the party? I mean, how much of a priority is that issue, opposing civil unions for gay couples?
That's a good question. Nobody really knows. The thing about the platform committee is that's one place where social conservatives within the party have really made a big push going back 20 years to try to organize and dominate. So social conservatives led in mainly by Phyllis Schlafly, really control that process. So the platform is likely to be more conservative on a lot of social issues than, say, the Republican representatives in Congress.
Now you mentioned Phyllis Schlafly. She was a big leader in the anti-equal rights amendment issue, you know, decades ago. And I don't hear her name very much anymore. Is she still a power in the Republican Party and among social conservatives?
Yeah, she really is. She really is. Watching the platform deliberations, that was quite clear to me and even a little bit surprising. She was way ahead of the game at developing a grassroots infrastructure around the country of social conservatives. So this year in the platform committee, the Republicans managing the committee on behalf of the Bush White House and campaign tried to streamline the process so they could just kind of rubber stamp their initiative. So it was hard for delegates to learn the name of other delegates. It was hard for outside groups that wanted to lobby the delegates to learn the name of the delegates. It was hard for others to get copies of the platform so that they could argue about what should be in it. But Phyllis Schlafly, through her organization Eagle Forum, had a number of representatives from different states, different state representations on the platform committee She had a number of Eagle Forum members who were actually on the committee, and that put her in a really strong position in terms of having input into the process. So when the White House and the Bush campaign were negotiating with social conservatives over how the platform might ought to be changed, okay, the White House had pretty much all the cards because they had most of the delegates, but those were bilateral negotiations pretty much with Phyllis Schlafly.
Now, you've been writing for months about how social conservatives and evangelical conservatives have been pressuring the Bush administration to be forceful in opposing gay marriage. And I think the first that you wrote about this was in relationship to a meeting that was organized by Donald Wildman, the founder of the American Family Association, and you describe him as a crusader against sex and violence in the media. What kind of meeting did he organize, and what influence do you think that had on the Bush administration?
To really understand this, you've got to go back to the 2000 election. The Bush campaign folks have said over and over again that they were disappointed to find that some 4 million conservative Christians failed to go to the polls. They expected 4 million more Christian conservative votes than arrived. And because of that, they feel they almost lost the election. So a big priority for them over these 4 years has been to give those people plenty of incentive to get to the polls this year. So against that backdrop, Dr. Wildman, Reverend Wildman, assembled a group of his friends and colleagues from Christian conservative lobbying organizations. And they got together and they said, in short, they said, we're losing the culture war. The culture is getting, if anything, more permissive and more, we believe, hostile to our values. And yet there's a sense that the Republicans, our party, are winning. They've got both houses of Congress and the president. Why aren't things going our way? Let's get together and see what we can do to try to combine our forces and get some things done. And looking now, this was before the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled in favor of gay marriage, that the state needed to recognize gay unions as equivalent to heterosexual unions. And these gentlemen, and a few ladies, but mostly gentlemen, sat around and said, what can we do? What's coming down the pike that we can organize around and get something done and make it a big part of this election? And they said, pretty much unanimously, same-sex marriage is going to be it. They saw a trend in some previous court decisions, including the Supreme Court ruling against sodomy statutes, that led them to believe this was going to be an even bigger issue in the future. And they thought it was one where they could really rally their troops and get something done. So they started preparing to pressure the White House on this and make it a part of the campaign even before it was in the national news. And after the Massachusetts Supreme Court ruled, then they began increasingly holding the president's feet to the fire and warning that if he didn't come out and say, we need a constitutional amendment to prevent this, that they would start doing things like going on the radio and telling the people who admire them and who share their values, hey, this president is out of step with us. And that might not seem like much, but in an election where the president is really focused on getting conservative Christians out to the polls, if a prominent evangelical Christian leader like, say, Dr. James Dobson, who's probably the most influential of that group, if a prominent leader like Dr. James Dobson starts going on his radio program and saying, you know what, the president's not getting it here. For some reason, he seems to be hesitating about protecting marriage. That could really be a problem for the White House.
How responsive was the Bush administration to this pressure from conservative evangelicals?
It depends on who you ask. If you're talking to a group like the Log Cabin Republicans, a group of gay Republicans, the White House was all too responsive. And yet, among Christian conservatives, there was quite a bit of impatience because it took the president a while to come out and call for the amendment. It took him several months after the Massachusetts court decision. This president has done a lot to appoint gay people to positions within his administration, and in some ways has gone out of his way to try to make gay people feel at home in the Republican Party. Gay Republicans who've met with him say that he always seems happy to see them, comfortable, understanding. And so it may be that he genuinely was reluctant to get involved in this issue. Also, for political reasons, I think he felt it behooved him to project an image of tolerance and not be too quick to jump on a divisive issue like this that some people could see as mean-spirited or even weirdly obsessed. As Grover Norquist, who's a prominent conservative strategist, said, you don't want to be the first person to use the word gay in the debate. Whoever uses the word gay first loses, because it looks like you're spending too much time thinking about these issues. So the president took his time before he got around to calling for the amendment.
There's something of a mixed message being sent out now by the Bush administration, because on the one hand you have this really anti-gay relationship, you know, anti-gay civil union, anti-gay marriage plank in the platform. And then a week before the convention, Vice President Cheney, who has a lesbian daughter, says that people should be allowed to love who they love and that states should decide whether gay marriages are going to be recognized or not. Is it intentional, do you think, that his statement was timed to coincide with the convention, or at least to be made just a few days before the start of the convention?
I don't think so. I have no idea what was going through the vice president's head or whether his advisors had told him he ought to say that or anything like that. But I do know that I recently interviewed the woman in Davenport, Iowa, who asked him that question. And based on my conversations with her, I'm sure she's not a plant. She very genuinely wanted to know the answer to that question. And she asked it with a long preface, something like, you know, Vice President, don't tell me what your advisors have told you to say. Don't tell me what you think the public needs to hear. Please just tell me what's in your heart. And I think, based on my conversations with friends of the family, that's what he did. His statements were not a surprise in that they're consistent with the things he said 4 years ago in the last campaign. But the timing unnerved some social conservatives.
So would you say that the Republican Party platform plank on gay marriage and gay civil unions is controversial within the party?
It is controversial within the party in that there are some Republicans, some moderate Republicans, some gay Republicans who are deeply, deeply troubled by it. On the other hand, the truth is that at the grassroots level, the question of gay marriage is very unpopular. Most people at the grassroots level of the party are quite opposed themselves to recognizing same-sex marriage. So I don't think this is going to trigger a big uproar within the party. In fact, I suspect that this part of the platform is soon to be forgotten. Like, who remembers that since 1980 there's been a plank in the platform calling for a constitutional amendment banning all forms of abortion? We just don't talk about that anymore.
Let's look at the Republican platform plank on stem cell research. Let's start with what the plank says.
We especially welcome and encourage a stronger emphasis on adult stem cell and cord blood stem cell research. We recognize that President Bush made a carefully considered decision to allow federal funding for stem cell research for the first time and did not affect stem cell research in the private sector. We strongly support the president's policy that prevents taxpayer dollars from being used to encourage the future destruction of human embryos.
So this is basically calling for a policy different from President Bush's policy, because President Bush has supported funding for certain lines of embryonic stem cells. And this is saying, like, no embryonic stem cell research should receive federal funding, yes?
No, this policy is absolutely consistent with what the president has said. The operative phrase here is, we call for a policy that prevents taxpayer dollars from being used to encourage the future destruction of human embryos.
I see.
So what the president has said that I'm going to allow federally funded research on pre-existing lines of embryonic stem cells, and I'm going to allow private research to go forward unimpeded. All I want to do is make sure that no federal money goes to harvesting new stem cells from embryos. So that is no taxpayer dollars taking embryos.
Now, was this embryonic stem cell research plank controversial within the party?
Yeah, totally controversial. It was controversial on both sides. Before the platform hearings began, a group of moderate Republicans tried to say to the president, listen, when you made this decision, it sounded like a good idea, but we now know that there are far fewer pre-existing embryonic stem cell lines than you thought. So saying it's okay for federally funded research on pre-existing embryonic stem cell lines to continue doesn't do that much for us. We think you should try to broaden this out and allow more research. Those people tried to make their case before the platform hearings began, and then they were pretty much out of the picture. At the platform hearings, social conservatives came and said, this isn't nearly enough protection for those embryos. Some opponents of abortion consider an embryo to be a human life. And so taking an embryo or a stem cell from an embryo is basically killing a baby. So they said, you're allowing this to go on in the private sector. That's crazy. What we need is a total ban on all embryonic stem cell research. And there was a bit of a scuffle in the platform hearings. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist of Tennessee, who was running the platform hearings and also happens to be a medical doctor, managed to fight off that opposition, partly with a long impassioned speech where he talked from his own perspective as a doctor about the potential of stem cell research and praised the kind of Solomonic wisdom of the president's decision. You know, on the one hand, protecting some embryos or limiting the research. On the other hand, trying to open up some lines of inquiry that could lead to developments later on.
Now, the abortion plank in the Republican platform remains virtually the same as it's been, a call for a constitutional amendment recognizing, you know, all human life and basically outlawing all forms of abortion. Abortion remains very controversial in the United States, but you don't hear as much discussion about the Republican abortion plank as you used to. Does that remain controversial within the party? And would you agree it's not talked about as much in public as it was before?
Well, that's a really interesting question. It's controversial within the party in the sense that there are a lot of moderate Republicans who are in favor of abortion rights. And in fact, many of them are speaking in prime time during the convention. That's the face they want to put forward. It's not talked about in part because in terms of the party's official position, the social conservatives have won. Nobody really credibly thinks that they're going to be able to challenge that position in the platform. The social conservatives just have a lock on that. Now, on the other hand, President Bush, during the last election, found that it was a good idea not to talk too much about abortion. He rarely used the word on the campaign trail. He would use code words that hardcore anti-abortion activists knew, like crisis pregnancy counseling center. If you're part of the anti-abortion movement, you know that refers to a counseling center that's going to dissuade a young woman who's pregnant from aborting her fetus. But in the 2000 election, he didn't talk that much about it. And in the 2000 platform, the party included their familiar call for a constitutional amendment banning abortion in every instance. But they buried those two paragraphs in a larger section of the platform, headlined something like protecting the rights of all. This year it's different. The president has signed a ban on partial birth abortion, and he talks about that all the time on the trail. And in the platform, there's a five-paragraph section called A Culture of Life that really emphasizes in a very upfront way the president's position on the abortion issue. And I think that's partly an appeal to those 4 million evangelical voters that the Bush campaign feels were missing in the 2000 election.
The original roster of speakers for the Republican convention featured mostly the moderate wing of the party, speakers like John McCain, Rudolph Giuliani, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And then after those speakers were announced, a group of more conservative speakers were added. What's behind that change?
No way to know, really. I know that there were conversations after the fact, after I and other newspaper reporters reported that a lot of social conservatives in the party were upset that they were being excluded from prime time. There were conversations between the White House and some of those people saying, look, why'd you have to mouth off like that? Because now when we add more social conservative speakers, it's going to look like we're just trying to make you guys happy. And we would have done it anyway. And maybe they would have done it anyway. I don't know. In any event, they're not getting the prime time spots. Most of the social conservative speakers that have been added to the platform are speaking earlier or later, so they're not the real focus of the convention.
Are the people who we are seeing at the podium representative of the larger party?
I would say that what we're seeing is not that representative. A lot of the speakers who are featured in prime time, like John McCain, Mary Giuliani, Arnold Schwarzenegger, have positions on some of the most contentious issues, the social issues, like questions about gay marriage or questions about abortion, that are at odds with the president and certainly at odds with the platform and probably at odds with most of the Republican Party represented in Washington. So I don't think it's that representative. The one speaker they've put in prime time that is appealing to social conservatives is actually a Democrat, and that's Zell Miller.
And he's going to be giving the keynote. He's a Democratic congressman, former governor of Georgia, who introduced Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was first being nominated for the presidency. How was he chosen to give the keynote at this Republican convention?
I don't know how he was chosen, but I think it was a very, very smart idea. If you look at the Republican base right now, a lot of what we call the Republican base are white conservative Christian voters who 30 years ago, 20 years ago, probably voted Democrat. So those are kind of swing voters in the sense that in a lot of cases, their pastor might say, vote Republican, but their union leader might say, vote Democrat. On the other hand, on social issues, they're also way over to the social conservative side of the Republican Party. So in a sense, he is an ideal guy to speak to those voters because he himself has been a Democrat and because he's very much in tune with them on the divisive social issues that are important to them, the conservative social issues about abortion and gay marriage and traditional values.
You mentioned early that the evangelical vote is very important to the Bush administration in this election, and that Karl Rove is very concerned that in the year 2000, the number of evangelical conservatives who actually showed up at the polls were about 4 million less than he projected. What is the Bush campaign trying to do to get out the evangelical conservative vote?
Well, the Christian conservatives themselves would say the most important thing to do to get out our vote is to govern in a way that is appealing to us. And to a certain extent, they're doing that. The president signed a partial birth abortion ban, which is very appealing. That's the first sort of anti-abortion victory in decades. And he's also called for a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, which some Christian conservatives think is very, very important. But that's not all the Bush campaign is doing. They're also making really unprecedented efforts to reach out to conservative Christian leaders and even to pastors, as well as to members of congregations, to try to get them to, you know, speak in their youth groups and their seniors groups at their churches about the importance of coming out to vote, to send in membership lists and telephone directories from their churches or religious groups so that the campaign can compare those lists with voter registration rolls and to hold a kind of citizenship Sunday where, for example, the pastor might ask everybody in the congregation who is registered to vote to stand up and then pass out voter registration forms to everyone who's left sitting. So they're really trying to use the existing organizations of churches and other religious groups as vehicles to try to remind voters to get to the polls.
Who are the most powerful, politically powerful, conservative evangelical leaders now, and how do they compare to the leaders of the Reagan era? Are they the same people, or are they different people?
They're different people. The early leaders of the sort of movement of evangelicals into politics were people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. A lot of evangelical Christians don't think of themselves as political. Historically, they have been less involved in politics than people of other faiths, in part because they took a kind of a view that politics is sort of worldly and sinful and not something that we should really be involved with. Let's just think about the next world to come and spiritual matters. And around the 70s, that started to change. And people like Jerry Falwell were at the forefront of mobilizing those people. Basically, the thinking was, you know, it's not enough for us just to stay home because we believe that the culture is turning against us and attacking our values. At least that's the way that a lot of conservative Christians put it to themselves at the time and still do. And what they mean by that are things like the Equal Rights Amendment, legalizing abortion, the sexual revolution, taking prayer out of the schools. They say that the culture began to feel hostile to them. And leaders like Falwell and Robertson and Timothy LaHaye began to mobilize conservative Christians to get into politics. Interestingly, Falwell and Robertson took a little bit of a hit among their religious following as they became more involved in politics. You know, a lot of people who would tune in to the 700 Club to watch Pat Robertson, they were tuning in for spiritual reasons. And so as he began to do things like running for president, they got a little bit turned off. The really influential conservative Christians today take a different approach. I would say that the two figures that at the top of the list in my mind would be Dr. James Dobson, who runs Focus on the Family, which is primarily a broadcasting and Christian self-help group. And the other figure would be Chuck Colson. Chuck Colson became famous as a figure in the Watergate scandal. Now he runs a ministry that's primarily for people in prison and coming out of prison. Neither of them is known among the people who really admire them as primarily a political figure. That doesn't mean they don't exert political influence, especially Dr. Dobson, who's set up, you know, sister organizations that are explicitly a lobbying organization, who's a common figure on Capitol Hill pushing for this or that, and who in recent decades has become a kind of must-see person for anybody who wants to run for president as a Republican. George Bush recently sat down with Dr. Dobson when he was out in Colorado Springs giving a speech at the Air Force Academy. So he has a kind of political influence, but he's always been very careful not to foreground his political role in his public persona, which remains somebody who, if you're a conservative Christian, you can turn to for biblically sound, what they consider biblically sound advice about how to bring up your family.
And how well connected is he with elected leaders? How well connected is he with the Bush administration or with conservatives who are in Congress?
If you're running for office in a state with a lot of conservatives, you've got to care what Dr. Dobson thinks, because many, many, many people listen to his radio broadcast and turn to him as a source of advice.
And he talks about these issues on the radio?
Yeah, but he's you know, in news organizations like our own at the New York Times, we have a tendency to write about him when he becomes involved in politics. But for the people who can be influenced by his leadership, the people who really admire him and think he's important, they listen to him because most days he's not talking about we got to get out there and vote against the marriage amendment. He's talking about, you know, this is what to do if your kid is getting out of hand. Here's a compassionate, biblical way to discipline your child. Or, you know, some people, you know, your grandmother is getting sick and this raises some issues for you. Here's a way to think about it. Or here's a story about a person who had a crisis in their life and through their faith turned it around. These are the things that he talks about most of the time. And that's what gives him some credibility when he then turns around and says, wait a second, this marriage stuff could really be a problem. Now, I should stipulate here, though, that you can't assume that just because Dr. Dobson thinks that this marriage matter is super important, that everybody who's listening to his radio show agrees. I'm still not sure how deep the passion is about the marriage issue in the pews. In a way, abortion is a more threatening issue to people than same-sex marriage, in part because the experience of having a baby is quite common, and it's not obvious even to a lot of heartfelt conservative Christians how somebody else's gay marriage affects their life.
Now, you recently wrote about a conservative group called the Council for National Policy, which met last week in New York, and you described this group as having a membership that includes some of the most powerful conservatives in the United States. What is the council?
The Council for National Policy is a group that was set up 23 years ago by Dr. Timothy LaHaye, who was one of the early leaders of the conservative Christian political movement, and Paul Weyrich, who's another figure who was influential at the founding of the New Right. And they set it up. At the time, what they said was, we need a conservative counterweight to what we believe is the liberalism of organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. What, to me, I have to say, is amusing is that they decided to make their council and its deliberations and its membership lists and the locations of its meetings and everything it talks about super secret. So members are not supposed to discuss any of that stuff. When they send emails to each other, they're not supposed to mention the name of the organization in the email for fear that it leaks out. I managed to obtain a list of who's a member and of the proceedings that were planned for this week at the Plaza Hotel in New York where they met. And frankly, I don't think the things they said and the things they talked about are that different from the things that they say, that group of social conservative, Christian conservative leaders. I don't think that they're, the things they said at that meeting are that different from the things that they would say in any other context. So it's a little bit funny to me that they wanted it to be so secret, but it really is revealing of how a lot of Christian conservatives feel like the culture and the media turned against them sometime back in the 70s and is still against them, even though they've got their guy in the White House. They've got a guy in the White House that a lot of Christian conservatives identify as one of their own and as a strong evangelical.
What was on the agenda, as far as you can tell?
a variety of things. A lot of it very supportive of President Bush. One of the things that struck me looking over the agenda is how many people from the administration and its allies were represented there. Senator Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, who's a close ally of the White House, received an award. There was a gentleman from the State Department speaking about how to handle Iran and its possible nuclear weapons. There was a gentleman from the Department of Justice talking about human trafficking, which is an issue that's very important to conservative leaders. There was also a lot of people talking about the importance of the election, who's going to win the election, what can be done to make sure that Christians vote, and even how the issue of gay marriage can be used to get people out to the polls, like specifically in Ohio, a big swing state. There's a ballot initiative underway to try to put a measure on the ballot in the fall, in the November election, that would put an amendment on the state constitution blocking same-sex marriage. And this is interesting to the Bush campaign in part because having that on the ballot will help motivate conservative voters to go to the polls. In public, the Bush campaign and the people who are organizing that effort in Ohio have said, this is not about trying to use this issue to drum up support for the president. This is just about marriage. It's completely unrelated. At the Council for National Policy, the gentleman who's leading that effort gave a speech that was basically about using socially conservative issues to get out the vote in the fall.
I don't know if you can answer this, but how would you compare the amount of political power that evangelical leaders have today compared to the amount of power, political power, that they had during the Reagan era?
During the Reagan era, evangelicals were still relatively new to national politics. I don't think there's any argument that they've ever had as much influence on national policy as they do today. The White House is, you know, every Monday there's a conference call set up out of the White House to stay in touch with prominent conservative Christian leaders around the country, to tell them what's going on at the White House and what the administration is working on. You know, a lot of that is just stuff like the economy's getting better, blah, blah, blah. But also to let them know that the White House wants to hear how they feel about things, to stay in touch with them. I don't think conservative Christians have ever been as well organized. I don't think they've ever voted to the extent that they do now. And I don't think they've ever been as influential.
Now, David, this is a beat that you started basically at the beginning of this year. And I'm wondering, what was behind the start of this new beat? And is it giving you a different sense of America than you had before? You'd been covering books before for the Times, the book industry.
No, it isn't giving me a different sense of America. One of the reasons why I was interested in covering this beat is because of the experience that I had covering the book industry and the media industry, where Christian books have really taken off. And a lot of the people who run the big publishing houses in New York, and that's basically a secular liberal bunch who live in Manhattan. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the people who run the book publishing industry. And they were quite surprised to find books like Dr. Timothy LeHaye's book about the Left Behind series, novels based on his reading of the book of Revelation and a Christian apocalypse soon to come. They were really surprised to find books like that that were quite out of keeping with their own worldview soaring to the tops of the bestseller list. And I'd written about that before, and so I was already fascinated by the strength of the conservative Christian market and the way that it had, in some sense, developed in parallel to the regular secular market. I mean, there are Christian bookstores, there are Christian publishers, there are Christian radio stations, there are some publishers and bookstores owned by the Southern Baptist Convention. And so there's a whole sort of separate market, and the people who would shop there would go to these stores because they were a little bit suspicious of the secular bookstores, and they wanted to go to a bookstore where they knew not only that they would find the books that they want, but they wouldn't be troubled by books that were offensive to them, that had, you know, dirty language or religious ideas that seemed heretical to them or pictures of, you know, sexy stuff. They wanted to shop in that kind of a pure atmosphere. And so I'd already become keenly interested in the development of this parallel economy, because at a certain point it began to cross over. As Walmart stores developed around the country, bringing book selling and music retailing to towns where there maybe hadn't been a designated bookstore or music store before, and they started adding special Christian sections to those stores, then sales of these kinds of products really went through the roof, and the mainstream media started to take notice and try to get into that market itself.
When you interview somebody for your beat covering conservative groups and individuals and issues for the New York Times, are you ever given a kind of litmus test before people respond, like, are you a person of faith? What is your religious background? You know, will you really understand from a personal point of view the perspective of a conservative Christian?
Most people don't try to quiz me. I've almost never been quizzed before the conversation starts. But there are. I've interviewed a lot of pastors, and I've interviewed a lot of very heartfelt evangelical Christians, and these are people who feel like it's very important to spread the gospel. That the biggest favor they could do for someone is to help them get to know Jesus Christ. So often at the end of the conversation, as we're walking to the door, someone will turn to me and say, and what's your own personal relationship with Jesus Christ? And I try not to say too much about that. What I say is that is the truth, and I go to a church, but I'm not going to tell you what kind of church, because one day I'm interviewing a Southern Baptist, one day I might be interviewing a Unitarian. And in the world we live in, those kinds of issues, theological issues or denominational issues or issues about what kind of church you attend, are political.
You're attending the Republican convention. You're watching it from the inside, not on television. Is there anything that you're particularly keeping an eye out for? Is there anything that you're looking for that you'd suggest we watch for?
Well, what I'm interested in is how the party plays both to moderates and swing voters as well as its base. I don't think I'm the only one interested in that. I think everybody is, in part because in 1992, they swung too far to the base. In particular, Pat Buchanan's speech about a culture war scared off a lot of people, and I think that really hurt them. In 2000, who knows, they may have gone too far the other way. President Bush, as we've said a minute ago, was very discreet about talking about his views on abortion and projected a very tolerant, welcoming face to moderate voters of the 2000 convention. But then they were disappointed by the turnout of evangelical voters. So I'm interested to see how they sort of walk that line at this convention. And I think the early indications are that they're doing a pretty good job. They have a number of speakers in prominent places that are going to appeal to real moderates. They have Zell Miller, who could appeal to former Democrats because he is one, but could also appeal to hardcore social conservatives because he's one of those too. And I think the most important thing is that even when they're not talking about policy, they're sending messages, and those messages are likely to appeal to a Christian conservative voter. Like, you'll hear a lot of gospel music. Last night, on the first night of the convention, there was a series of testimonials from widows of people who had died in the attacks of September 11th. And in those testimonials, they often referred to prayer, to God. And there was a moment of silence at the end. And then a member of the New York City Police Department sang Amazing Grace. And that's not going to turn off anybody. That's not saying, you know, if you're not a Christian, you're not welcome here. You know, they also had some Muslim speakers on the list. But if you are a Christian, that resonates with you. The other thing that I was struck by last night watching the convention is how natural it seems for the Republicans. You know, at the Democratic convention, when John Kerry quoted Abraham Lincoln about how, you know, we ought not to say that God is on our side, we ought to hope that we're on God's side. You know, that's a line that really strikes a chord with a lot of Christians of all stripes. That is a very popular line that is going to be very appealing to a lot of people. But you know what? It seemed kind of forced. It seemed like, you know, I heard it and I thought, oh, I see. The Democrats are trying to get on the religion bandwagon a little bit. With the Republicans, in part because I think faith comes so easily to President Bush, it doesn't seem that way. And so when they sing a hymn or they refer to prayer, it really grabs the constituency that they're trying to speak to, and they can do that without having to discuss from the podium at the convention divisive issues like same-sex marriage or abortion.
Well, David Kirkpatrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
David Kirkpatrick covers the conservative movement's issues and leaders for The New York Times.